I am Dahlia Lithwick, and welcome to Blogging Heads TV. And I'm very happy to introduce my blogging compatriot today and friend, Benjamin Wittes, who is a fellow and researcher at the Brookings Institution. He writes for The New Republic. He blogs for Slate at Convictions. And he was an editorial writer for The Washington Post. Hi, Ben.
Hey. And Wittes is from the same room, even. Ben Wittes, and I'm delighted to introduce the only truly unique voice in American legal journalism, famed Charlottesville resident, and incredible legal affairs writer, Dahlia Lithwick of Slate, and who also writes for Newsweek, right? And just about everywhere else, too. And I guess we're here to talk about military trials and terrorism, anti-terrorism law more generally, starting with Thursday, where we're going to have a big event of sorts, the arraignment of the high-value detainees in front of a military commission, which is these special tribunals that were set up under the Military Commissions Act at Guantanamo. And these high-value detainees are really the people who are believed, or many of the people who are believed to be at the core of the 9/11 conspiracy, at least that group that are in custody at this time.
And you know, one of the things that's really interesting is that the press is being allowed in en masse. There's going to be a big, huge influx of reporters who are going to be able to sit in the courtroom at Guantanamo. They're going to clap eyes on people like Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, you know, one of the alleged architects of 9/11, for the first time. So there's an enormous drama factor. And I think one of the things that Ben and I wanted to start talking about was, where does that drama factor fit into, you know, the larger project here, which is doing justice at Guantanamo Bay? So I wanted to start by asking Ben the question, what's the best possible outcome? I mean, after years and years of trying to set up a military tribunal system at Guantanamo, we're actually going to see some real live justice being done, presumably. And I wanted to ask your views on what's the best possible outcome and the worst possible outcome in your mind.
Well, it's a very complicated question, and I think it depends what you believe, you know, whether you're talking about the outcome in an individual case or whether you're talking about the outcome for the creation of a justice system that's capable of handling terrorists of this magnitude and caliber and expertise and, you know, in their framework, success. And the trouble is that, you know, as unless you've been living in a cave, you know already. These trials have been extremely difficult to get off the ground, and there was, you know, so to go back briefly over the history of it, the Bush administration in the immediate aftermath of September 11th tried to set up a system of military trials, which were sort of a revival of a type of trial that hadn't really been used since World War II or the era just after World War II. And this got bogged down in a lot of litigation. Finally, the Supreme Court said, no, you can't do that without an act of Congress. The administration goes back and gets an act of Congress, and now immediately got bogged down again in, you know, a series of kind of difficult pretrial machinations in some of these lesser cases that they've brought. They then really upped the ante by bringing a case against, I guess initially, six of the really top people. One of them, that case didn't get referred, and so it's been sort of dropped for now. But the result is that you have now, for the first time, really the rubber hitting the road, which is to say, in the cases that people really care about, you know, we have to see how this system performs. And so when you say what the best case scenario is, in any situation, I think the if you're looking at the individual case, the best case scenario is that the government makes a series of allegations. Those allegations are, we hope, true. The defendant accepts responsibility for the true allegations that are made against him and pleads guilty, and that's the end of it. And that I think is the best the best case scenario for the individual case. Now, that's a little bit complicated in this case because there are still all these very difficult outstanding questions about the legitimacy of the tribunals. And part of what the government is trying to do is to establish the vitality of this system. Now, if you walk in and you say, so, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, did you do all this stuff? And he says, why, yes. I'm pleased to tell you that I'm guilty of everything. And in fact, I did much more than you've merely alleged, which is what he's done in the past when asked questions like this. If you ask that question and you get that answer, it actually does relatively little to establish the legitimacy of the system or to establish the capability of the system to handle what a trial system really has to be able to establish, which is contested issues of fact and the circumstance in which the defendant says, actually, no, I've not done any of this, and the only reason I seem to have is that you tortured it out of me, or you waterboarded me, or you did the following terrible things either to me or to somebody else. And I think the capacity of this system to handle situations like that is still very, very much in dispute. And so I think that the best thing that could happen for the world and for the, in the case of the 9/11 conspirators would be to have, them walk in and plead guilty and take responsibility for it. I think some of them may do that. That would be a terrific victory for the Bush administration. And it would leave us very much where we started in the question of, well, what would happen if you had a contested issue here? And I think it would do very little to resolve that. So in one sense, that's the best case scenario. In another sense, that's less than that. In another, in a different way, you can say reciprocally, you would want, the best case scenario would be, if you're trying to establish the legitimacy of this system, would be to have a seriously contested litigation over the guilt of some of these people, and to use it to show that the system is either capable or not capable of resolving these things in a way that is perceived as fair and is in fact fair. And that way we would actually have some answers to the questions, that we've all been struggling with, which is what is a reasonable system for trying terrorists actually look like?
I think one of the things that's so interesting about this is that the Pentagon has arranged for 9/11 families to watch these hearings, and it raises the question to me, what part of this, sorry to harp on my theater point, but because I think you're right, there's a component of this that is theater, which is you've got people who've been incarcerated for years without access to, their families, without access to counsel for a long time, without knowing the charges against them necessarily. Some of them have been, abused, we think. Some of them have been waterboarded, and they're going to get a chance to talk.
Right.
And talk they will. And it raises some of the questions about closure that arose to my mind during the Zacharias Moussaoui trial that I covered, the pretrial hearings there. And some of those issues of when you try to sort of set up a Nuremberg, you want a sort of theater of redemption, a theater of justice, and a theater of closure for the victims. But you can't control what people say. And I remember coming out of the Moussaoui proceedings feeling kind of that same sense that I have right now going into this, which is the last thing I would expect to come out of this is closure, is some sort of emotional relief, is some sense for these victim families that justice writ large has been done. Now, maybe that's just a function of the fact that it's been too many years, the system has been scuttled and scuttled and scuttled again, the allegations of the system as being really a set of kind of kangaroo courts that exist only to get convictions are so pervasive now in the eyes of the world, the whole system is so tainted. So what worries me a little bit is this notion that the end game here, to the extent that there's an end game, is to show, to showcase and show off that we can bring justice, but even more poignantly, to give some sort of relief, not just to these families, but to the country. And I have to wonder, A, at what price this relief is coming, but B, one of the most interesting aspects to me of I think it was Clive Stafford Smith's book about the Guantanamo trials, was describing pretrial proceedings where everybody's handed a script, you know, and that the prosecutor has a script and the defense attorney has a script and the judge has a script. It's nice. It's like MTV. And you know, but the defendants don't read from the scripts. And I think that makes two points. One is these things are being made up on the fly, and the only way to contain that is to script it. But that when you have really, I think, taken away someone's voice for so many years, the one power KSM has left is to just come uncorked. And I worry terribly that if we're looking to this system for relief, some kind of closure or relief, we're not going to get it.
I actually am quite confident that we won't get it. But I think we also didn't get it in the Sally. You know, there was, which you know as well as anybody, they, you know, in a case like, in a case where the crime is essentially unlimited, and the capacity of human punishment, even in a world with the death penalty, is actually pretty limited. And the list of things that we won't do is pretty long, and the list of things that we will do is pretty short. We might execute you, and we will lock you up forever, whether or not you're convicted. we already have done that. Under those circumstances, you know, given the enormity of, it's kind of in somewhat the same way as, you know, even under the best of circumstances, and these are far from the best of circumstances, you are talking about, in a Nuremberg-like way, there's sort of no way to approach through a justice system kind of what the magnitude of the offense is, and therefore there's some kind of a mismatch between it, even if you could do it well. And our problem is, of course, that we have not figured out how to do it at all, let alone to do it well. And you know, as we get this thing going, there's really nobody really knows if it's going to work, and you know, nobody knows, and work even at a minimal level, that is to say, can you pull off a trial that won't from the beginning be understood as, you know, a show, a kangaroo court, all the things that are, you know, sort of commonly bandied about, in my view, somewhat unfairly, but not entirely unfairly, about the Military Commissions Act. And the, we're still, it's not unprecedented, of course. They had to do that with Nuremberg, too, which kind of came out of nowhere as a sort of ad hoc response to a circumstance. The difference is that Nuremberg was understood to be the most generous thing you could possibly do, was to put these people on trial before you hanged them. Whereas we started with, you know, a baseline set of expectations that we would try people in federal court, and then kind of scaled it back. And so there's a even though these tribunals are much more generous to the accused in many ways than the Nuremberg trials were, they have a legitimacy crisis, and you know, given how terribly they've been administered, they should have a legitimacy crisis.
How much do you think? And I know we'll talk more about the legitimacy crisis, but how much do you think the core problem here was that when Guantanamo was conceived of, the object was not to have criminal trials? The object was, in the very immediate aftermath of 9/11. And that's always been, I think, a tension in this administration's policy. You know, on the one hand, we got the ticking time bombs. We want to find out as much as we can find out, including and up to, you know, waterboarding. And we want to stave off the next attack. That's a very, very different sort of strategic set of decisions than you would make if you were going into prosecuting a criminal trial. And it seems to me that those got conflated along the way, that we sort of cherry-picked the best of both, but that we didn't go into Guantanamo saying, at the end of the day, what we want to do is see justice done. We want to have trials. What we said was, let's grab some guys, let's waterboard the crap out of them and find out what they know, and then deal with the rest later.
I actually don't think they got conflated, but I, in fact, I think I think what happened was we said we wanted to do both, and one totally dominated the other because it is, in fact, a more significant short-term strategic interest. But I do think the answer to your question is that that's the core of the problem. That, you know, what you have in the conventional criminal justice system, there is a very tight relationship between detention and trial, which is to say that you can't lock somebody up, you can't detain them unless you're going to put them on trial. So the fact that you may be a very dangerous character, and as we all know you are, doesn't entitle anybody to lock you up. In a wartime setting, with respect to the fighters of the other side, so if you're thinking about the war on terrorism as a literal war, which is the way Congress authorized it, the way the administration has very consistently understood it, there's a total disconnect between the power to try and the power to detain. You're allowed to lock up the enemy because they're the enemy, and you're allowed to lock them up for as long as the war goes on. And then you can try them sort of if you feel like it. And so if the goal is to neutralize as many of the enemy as you can, you can accomplish that without trying anybody. And under a very low evidentiary threshold. The evidentiary threshold is if you say he's a member of the other side, then he is, and you can lock him up.
Or if you tortured somebody else and they say he's a member
right.
of the other side.
But even if, you know, the amount of evidence that you need is really a matter of your own reckoning. And so you have this very low threshold for detention. And then, you know, the truth is trying somebody in U.S. federal court is really hard. And, you know, the Massawi case, which is a great example of that. You know, people argue about whether it was an example of the fact that it can be done and therefore should be done. And the judge who sat on that case, Judge Brinkema, recently gave a talk in which she really held it out as a model of that, you know, look, we can really do this. Or whether you look at it like I do and say, eek, you know, that really raises a, you know, question of how many times could you do that, right? If you have as your baseline that if you don't bring Zacharias Massawi to trial, then say he lives in Cleveland, you know, you have an incredible incentive to bring him to trial. But if your baseline is he lives at Guantanamo and you have him in a cage and or a four-walled cell and he's very safely contained, there's very little incentive to bring him to trial. And I think what we've seen over the last 7 years is that in such an environment, the number of trials is very small because the incentive to make them happen is very small. It's only when you get people like the high-value detainees who are people who, you know, it is sort of unthinkable that in the long run we wouldn't bring to trial, that over time that incentive to bring them to trial to sort of do the justice thing, right, sort of overwhelms or becomes a value and a strategic interest on a par with getting whatever intelligence they have and simply removing them from the world universe of people who can hurt you. And I think until we figure out what we want that relationship to be, you will, between detention and trial, it's going to be extremely difficult to have a system in which trial is you have a significant incentive to make trials happen.
Do you
disagree with that?
Well, I mean, I think you and I are much. I think we both agree where Guantanamo has gone horribly awry. I'm not sure that I'm much less sanguine than you about the possibility of salvaging anything from Guantanamo. I think, you know, one of the places you and I disagree, I think, is the notion that, to me, once there's been torture testimony, you know, once there's been, you know, allegations of command influence, you know, once you have a judge who, as we're hearing now, you know, Peter Brownback, who was the judge in the Omar Khadr case, and he was the guy who you may recall is a Canadian, my compatriot, B, picked up at age 15 in Afghanistan and has been warehoused for years and years. Arguably, you know, some interesting issues about him being a minor in the first place, but the judge who was overseeing his trial was a little ticked with the prosecution for not turning over documents that including details about his interrogation, made that quite clear, and summarily is removed last Friday from overseeing the trial. So those kinds of things telegraph to me that we have a fundamentally unworkable system when you've got the same entity that is prosecuting, also warehousing, and also judging. It's very convenient. But I think that we've hit, to my mind, a place at which I don't think that credibility can be restored. And so I think I don't disagree with you on principle that if we were to go in the Wayback Machine and it was September 13th, 2001, and you and I could put our heads together and say, how do we, and this is another question that we should probably talk about, but, you know, is the world different fundamentally than it was on September 10th? If so, how do we create a system that isn't cobbled together from bad World War II precedent and, you know, MacGyver-like chewing gum and glue? How do we create some system that achieves both the ends we're talking about? You know, both play some part in detaining and warehousing people who are dangerous and allowing us to pump them for evidence of imminent attack, and also, I think, starts us down a meaningful path to something that looks like criminal justice. I think we would have done better than the system at Guantanamo. So I think we can agree on that. Where I think I part ways with you is that, to me, once waterboarding is in the picture, all bets are off. I think these can't be salvaged.
But I don't know that I disagree with you that once waterboarding is in the picture, it can't be salvaged, unless you walk in and the defendant says, yeah, I was waterboarded, but so what? I did it, all right? I mean, there are specific, very fact-dependent circumstances in which you could imagine the situation being salvaged, either because there's an absolutely ironclad set of evidence that's really not tainted, or because the defendant simply doesn't, you know, our criminal justice system kind of assumes that the defendant, you know, wants to defend himself. And sometimes that's not the case when you have people who really do see themselves as warriors. And but the problem doesn't go away once you say this is unsalvageable, because you still have to figure out what to do with those people. So let's say, you know, for example, the military commission's authorities, the convening authority, people who are responsible for putting this together, refuse to certify charges against one of the 9/11 defendants. And this is a very scary guy who was interrogated quite brutally by the military, actually, not by the CIA. And let's imagine for a minute that they fail to file more charges against him. What do you then do with him? Does he then walk free? Do you hold him in detention forever? Without trying him? And if you can do that, then really what's the point of having trials? I think it doesn't quite answer the big problem to say, well, the military commission's process is, if you believe it's fatally flawed, as you do, or if you believe it has some very substantial problems, as I do. And I for the record, I think that I actually agree with you that command influences, real or apparent, is the principal problem with the military commission's process, and that the way you should fix that is actually having a U.S. federal judge preside over these proceedings and bring them under the auspices of U.S. courts. So whether you believe that you could kind of do a lot of good and fix these problems to some degree with sort of sensible legislation, or whether you believe it's basically hopeless and we've blown it, you still are left with this problem, well, what do you do with these guys? And I don't actually think that, you know, sort of all the people who are, you know, railing against the military commission's process, is their answer to it, well, okay, Catani should be released if he can't be prosecuted in U.S. court? I just can't go there.
Right. And certainly I agree with you. This is why I haven't written the piece of what we do with them. I'm not sure bringing them stateside and trying them, you know, in Cleveland is a great idea either. I wonder if, you know, part of the problem, and sorry to harp on Moussaoui, but I think it was a problem that was illuminated in Moussaoui. It was a problem that's been illuminated in a lot of these sort of low-level paintball terrorism prosecutions, that, you know, the Michigan prosecutions, is that we have, you know, this very, very slippery conspiracy doctrine that we use to say, all right, you haven't actually done anything, but you are ready to do something. And the time between your readiness to do something and your doing something is the 40 seconds in which you get a phone call, you know, and then get on the plane to bomb the towers. And I think, you know, again, if we're going to go in the Wayback Machine, we should really not only be thinking about a way to reconcile the problem we've already discussed, which is the problem of how do you achieve two criminal justice aims at the same time. You know, one is having fair and reasonable trials. Another is, oh, my God, we have KSM. Let's do something with him. I think there's another problem, which is that the criminal law is inherently backward-looking. And an awful lot of the folks that we picked up at Guantanamo, you know, Hamdan being a good example, probably kind of a bad guy, you know, certainly liked the notion of, you know, jihad, and certainly probably had he been activated to do something really bad, might have played along. But we have a real problem with the existing conspiracy laws in this country. And I think that one of the reasons some of these trials have, you know, bordered on farcical is because you can't really put on a good show trial based on someone's bad thoughts.
Yeah, and I think, you know, Hamdan is an interesting example of that. This is a guy who was Osama bin Laden's personal driver and kind of moved some military equipment around. He's clearly a jihadist. It's an interesting question what criminal law any of that violates. I mean, other than in some very sort of attenuated sense of a conspiracy, it's an interesting sort of thought experiment to go through and kind of figure out what the fact pattern is in which that his activities are a crime prosecutable in U.S. federal court under the law that existed in 2001. I'm not certain it isn't a crime, but I would be interested to see the indictment that would survive scrutiny.
So let's talk about your book.
Oh, I'm always happy to talk about my book.
This has been, well, why don't you talk about it? I'll hold it up.
Well, this is my modest effort to rewrite all of the law of the war on terrorism. and the basic idea of it is an argument, first of all, that the law of terrorism should be a principally a congressional project and not, as it has been over the last 7 or 8 years, a sort of dialogue between the judiciary and the executive branch, in which Congress kind of shows up when the executive branch says, hey, we need help. And secondly, to try to imagine in a sort of a high altitude way that a general interest reader can really kind of get his or her mind around what a set of legal regimes that would govern the areas that we're all kind of concerned about. That is, in my opinion, their detention, trial, interrogation, surveillance. These are sort of the big ones, and these are the issues that we're fighting about. And what does a set of, you know, regimes or legal frameworks for those look like? And the idea was to sort of try to put behind us a little bit the sort of fights of the last 7 years on the theory that the next administration, whether it's John McCain or I guess we're allowed to say Barack Obama now.
Not yet.
Barack Obama or Hillary Clinton, is very unlikely to want to take the sort of pure executive power model approach to these things that the current administration did, and therefore is going to have a very sustained engagement with Congress. And this is sort of an attempt to imagine what that engagement looks like and what a responsible Congress would do.
One of the things that I think is really interesting that you're trying to do systemically and fairly in this book is examine, it's kind of what we've been talking about, what is the proper role of courts? What oversight responsibility is there for courts? And I couldn't agree with you more, sorry to agree, but I couldn't agree with you more that the way the Supreme Court particularly has weighed in has been just an incredibly curious dance between President Bush and the court, and you know, things that seem fundamental, you know, Rasul, Al-Oda, you know, Hamdi, Hamdan, that seem to be the things that, you know, I once thought I'd be telling my great-grandchildren about. I think you point out they're very curious efforts.
Well, they have this weird quality of momentousness that turns out not to be that momentous, and turns out to be not that momentous relatively quickly. And so they have these weird dual levels. So, for example, Hamdan, which, you know, is sort of the most dramatic example of this, comes down, I mean, I think, you know, Walter Dellinger, who used to be the was the Solicitor General in the Clinton administration, used to run the Office of Legal Counsel of Justice, describes Hamdan as the most important decision about executive power ever.
In Slate.
And it was a, you know, and this was not atypical of the way people were talking about it. And yet, within 3 months of Hamdan's coming down, virtually nothing that the Supreme Court had done had Congress not undone. And the Supreme Court permitted this because it had designed the case very, very carefully to avoid a constitutional holding. And because they do that, avoid the constitutional holding, this allows Congress to come in here and say, well, I know you think we said this, but now we're really saying this, you know. And so the case kind of, you know, if you think about the case as having done three things, basically, it overturns military commissions, Congress reinstated the commissions. It applies a provision of the Geneva Conventions that the administration had said don't apply. Congress writes a very careful little statute saying, well, yes, of course it applies, but here's how you can violate it if you feel like it. And the third thing is that the Congress had said, you know, we don't want these cases to be in federal court at all, and the Supreme Court had said, well, yes, they do get to be in federal court, and Congress turns around immediately and says, oh, no, they don't. And so the three major things that the Military Commissions Act did are all gone within a few months. And I think this is a very typical example of the way the court has behaved, which is to say to push, but not to decide the fundamental questions. And the result is that today, oddly, despite these sort of serial defeats that the administration has suffered, all of the fundamental questions that we face in the fall of 2001 and the winter of 2002, that is, what can you do with people when you catch them, when you think they're terrorists, but you're not really sure, and maybe you are sure, but you can't prosecute them, you know, all those questions, we're not really a lot closer to the answers to those questions today than we were 7 years ago. And a lot of the fault for that properly belongs with the administration. But in my judgment, the court has not gotten... The court gets a little bit of a free ride for having sort of pretended to answer a lot more of these questions than it's actually addressed. And to me, the villain that nobody focuses on is Congress, which, you know, is supposed to be the body that writes laws in this sort of, I have this very kind of fifth grade civics class attitude toward this. And, you know, we live in a society in which, you know, people yell and scream about activist judges who usurp the power of legislatures. Well, here's a bunch of legislators who are so, you know, anemic about the exercise of their own power that they end up ceding it both to the courts and to the executive branch, which kind of has to, both of which to some extent have to step in and fill the gaps. And I think people don't focus on the scope and seriousness of Congress's abdication of its own function.
And that was a theme of Jack Goldsmith's book, The Terror Presidency, that, you know, what do you do with a supine Congress? Particularly in wartime, Congresses tend to default to, you know, laying down and hoping some big boy makes the decisions. And that's essentially what happened. And I'm curious, I know what, you know, Jack's hypothesis was. I'm curious to hear, what's your thought on what it was that led Congress to all but give up on trying to sort of have a seat at the table when it came to the war on terror?
Well, I think there is a structural problem, which is that, you know, the executive has, you know, all the power in that relationship on this stuff. And the reason is simply, and I don't say unitary here in the nasty sense of the unitary executive theory, but just in the sense that the presidency is a unitary actor, and the Congress is an incredibly divided actor, divided between parties, divided between houses, divided between 535 individual members, and it's very, very easy for the president to act and very hard for Congress to act. So there's a structural dimension. There's also a personality dimension, that members of Congress don't love taking responsibility for things. And to the extent that the executive, one of the dark sides of executive authority is, you know, from the point of view of Congress, it's very attractive, because if the president can take responsibility for, you know, things like interrogation, we don't have to take a stand on either side of it. But, you know, interrogations are really hard questions, so we get to avoid it. And we get to take credit if things go well and don't have to take responsibility if things go badly. And so there's a self-protective instinct on Congress's part as well. And then finally, I think, you know, Jack Goldsmith has a very astute historical observation, which is that Congress acts in wartime at the president's request. And that's, you know, and you have to imagine the kind of robust congressional involvement that I'm describing and that I'm asking for and pleading for. I think you have to imagine a presidency that wants it and that invites it. And, you know, my lodestar in this actually is the Clinton administration, where my whole introduction to this set of subjects was when then Deputy Attorney General Jamie Gorelick went up to Congress in 1994 to ask for the ability to go to the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court, the secret court that handles surveillance requests, to get it to be able to authorize physical searches as well as wiretaps. And, you know, she was quoted actually in a story by a young reporter named Ben Wittes at the time as saying that she believed that the Justice Department had inherent authority without a statute to do this stuff. But she just thought they would all feel more comfortable if they were acting under an act of Congress with a federal judge looking at it. And so this was a very different vision of executive authority. It was the idea that executive power comes, yes, it has roots in the Constitution, but it also has roots in getting Congress to say, yes, you get to do this. You know, yes, this is allowed. We've thought about this problem, and we think, you know, physical searches or, you know, maybe detention, you know, without trial is sometimes appropriate. And, you know, these are very hard questions. And when the executive is acting on its own, it's very, very isolated. It has the ability to do things, but it also, that ability doesn't sustain for a very long time. And Congress really is in the position to legitimize a lot of those actions, but they're not going to do it without presidential leadership. And so, you know, I think the encouraging thing actually about both Obama and McCain is that I think for slightly different reasons, there's reason to be optimistic that either of them will see some sort of sustained engagement with Congress, partly taking the negative lessons of this administration as very much in his interest, I think, or in Clinton's, I'll nod to Clinton still, in her interest.
It's funny because I think this whole sort of trope of secrecy, unnecessary secrecy, may well be not just the legacy of the Bush administration, but of what went so wrong at Guantanamo. I mean, this sort of lack of transparency that to some degree became an end in itself. I mean, even today, you know, before we started taping, we were talking about why was Judge Brownback let go, you know, at the Omar Khadr trial. And the lack of explanation itself becomes so suspect. And it seems to me that over and over again, either decisions are taken, you know, oh, let's just violate FISA in secret, you know, oh, let's just, you know, have a rendition program in secret. Now, I get it. You know, it's wartime, and we don't actually announce things on CNN. But it seems to me that every turn in the road was made much more fraught and more difficult by the secrecy, and then the sort of overarching theme. You know, now you see it in the state secrets doctrine. You know, that now you're not just, you know, it's not just that secrecy is an end in itself; it's sort of become a shield by which to block any scrutiny of wrongdoing. And it seems to me that this administration came in with a penchant for secrecy that predated 9/11. Absolutely. I mean, this was an administration that had a problem with scrutiny. And in that sense, it's sort of a tragic perfect storm that, you know, I mean, we can use the unprecedented level of secrecy to say, you know, everything that happens behind closed doors is therefore, you know, done for pernicious reasons. Clearly, Brownback was dismissed from the Khadr proceedings for bad reasons. And I think your point is, had there been a little bit more transparency, we wouldn't have today such absolutely overwhelming doubt about motives and about intent. And it seems to me that that really has been at the core of some of the problem here, is that secrecy has far surpass the need for secrecy.
I hate to agree so much, but I think you're but I think you don't need to reach the point of renditions or you know the NSA problem where there really is you know everybody who's been briefed on it seems to accept that there's some real secrets there that you need to protect. To prove you that your point is not just correct, but sort of flamboyantly correct. The example that I really almost fell out of my chair when I first saw was the hearing transcripts from not the military commissions at Guantanamo, but what are called the CSRTs. These are cursory little tribunals.
I think I call them MIC tribunals.
Yeah.
Because they're sort of drive-through.
They're kind of a quick and very dirty little tribunal designed to determine whether you're an enemy combatant and therefore subject to detention. The amazing thing about these tribunals, which are, you know, they're a sort of complicated discussion in and of themselves, and I have a long discussion of them in the book, but the amazing thing about these tribunals is in how many of them the person really kind of admit something pretty substantial. And if I had been running the military's, you know, handling of these, I would have had C-SPAN come and film these sessions. I think there are a lot of people who, and I mean that actually literally, there are a lot of people down there who say some pretty dramatic and pretty scary things when you ask them, who are you? I quote one of them. This is not verbatim, but I quote one of them in the book who you know starts out his hearing by saying, "I didn't come here to defend myself. If you guys decide I'm an enemy combatant, I'll wear that as a badge of honor in this world and the next. I came here to." And he leaves the hearing shouting, "May God help me kill the infidels." And you know there are some very very terrifying people who. You know, the question of what you do with them is a really, really hard question. The proposition that you need to do something with them shouldn't have been difficult. And, you know, they were in custody and they were saying things. And we should have broadcast that to the entire world as a way of, you know, both as a way of transparency with respect to our own procedures, but also as a way of, you know, talking about who the enemy is here, you know, and I think one of the virtues, as you know, I'm in many ways alarmed by how the Massawi trial went. But one of the virtues of it was that the world got a chance to see who Zacharias Massawi was, and the only question at the end of that process was he crazy? There was no question about was he an al-Qaeda figure sent here to do enormous damage to Americans? I suppose there was some question of how involved with 9/11 he was particularly. There was no question that Zacharias Massawi was a really scary guy who was sent here to, you know, take flight training. And, we should be scared of people like that. The comparable people at Guantanamo, we still don't know in the way that we know Zacharias Massawi. And that's a failure both of our own ability to talk about our own processes, but it's also a failure of our ability to talk about the enemy.
Well, and I think that loops us right back to where we started, which is on Thursday, people are going to see KSM. I mean, they're going to see Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, who would have been a really good bad guy once upon a time before we waterboarded him. And I think that it really, arguably, he's crazier now than he was before, and I don't know what we're going to see. But to me, I think that's one of the tragedies, is that this entire proceeding, including the CSRTs, including everything that was classified, including the bizarre, you know, grabbing of Speedo bathing suits that, you know, that detainees wanted. I mean, at every level, you know, you can't have a cycling magazine, but you can have, it was all so excessive and extreme that you came away from everything that's happened at Guantanamo as though it was this sort of tinkering under the hood, you know, wrench, you know, screwdriver, nut, bolt, you know, all of it happening in the dark, some creepy, you know, agreement over David Hicks, the Australian, which is the one conviction we've now seen in all these years at Guantanamo, and it was a plea bargain, you know, and what was his sentence, like 4 minutes in prison and never talking about it again. I mean, if anything...
And gets to serve in Australia.
Right, in Australia where, you know, he as long as he doesn't write a book, He served the terms of his... I mean, this is the most dangerous guy we had at Guantanamo, and I think that that profound, profound self-serving secrecy is the reason that, you know, they just look so suspect. Now, it's not helping that the poster boy is at Guantanamo from Charlie Swift, who was, you know, charged with you know, who was a military guy who was charged with defending Hamdan to Mo Davis, who was the prosecutor there, the guy who wrote the glowing love letter op-ed about how great the Guantanamo system was, and then until he decided it sucked. You know, and I think that when you have defections from people who are lifelong career military people who deeply believe both in the mission of the military and in the rule of law, and they're starting to say this thing is corrupt from the inside out, that goes to this fundamental thing that you're citing and I'm citing, which is why all the secrecy? Why did everything happen in the dark? Why was everything and its mother classified? And I do think it goes to what we talked about at the very, very beginning as well, Ben, which is if we'd had the time and the luxury to invent a system that solved for a multitude of criminal justice problems on September 12th of 2001, we probably would have come up with a better system.
But that raises the question, you know, we didn't do it, but we still need to, because eventually we're going to catch more people. We certainly hope we are, since, you know, eventually... we still have to conduct surveillance, which we haven't really talked about, but we still have to do all the things that, you know, we've been doing in one way or another. We still have to put people on trial. We still need to go through that exercise. And so, I mean, I guess the question is, you know, how do you do it now? And is there a moment in which we can all say, and maybe it's the incoming next administration, where we can all say, all right, the executive branch as it is now is not responsible for the executive branch of the last 7 years. Congress is not the same Congress as it was for much of that. You know, can we now take a big, thick black marker and say, that's the past, now we're looking this way? And if so, you know, has one of the consequences of, you know, this scope and intensity of our disagreements made it so that we're much farther apart on the fundamental issues than we were a few years ago. And I hope very much that we can do that. But I think, you know, we've made it a lot more difficult for ourselves, you know, on a whole series of policy questions than it would have been a few years ago.
I think that's right. I think that the level of mistrust is absolutely pathological on both sides. And clearly not everybody at Guantanamo was an aid worker, you know, and clearly not everybody at Guantanamo is KSM. And the fact that we've now, you know, atomized into you know, two camps that believe one of those two narratives, I think goes a long way towards answering that first question about what's the best outcome and the worst outcome here. It does seem to me that in the intervening time, we've had really smart legal scholarship on this question. You know, we've had outside and inside the administration some serious rejiggering of you know, what was once absolutely, you know, hard and fast, unbreakable lines. I think that everybody has taken a sober second look. And you're right, we need to look forward at this very, very, you know, exigent question of what are we going to do if the Guantanamo hearings do break down. But it seems to me that the lessons, to the extent that there are lessons, are Congress needs to get involved. The president needs to not be, you know, a megalomaniac. And I think that, you know, there's a huge vacuum here in scholarship and leadership about if this is, in fact, a different kind of war, if we're facing a war that doesn't end, if the criminal justice paradigm doesn't work, if standard conspiracy doctrine doesn't work, we got to build something new. And I think you're right to say Congress needs to take the lead there.
I agree with all of that. And I would say there are certain behaviors now on both sides of the sort of divide over this stuff that have been learned and need to be unlearned. You know, and you know, one of them is going to be, you know, and this is actually a pretty good argument for an Obama presidency, you know, is that somebody on the left, you know, a left political leader or a center-left political leader, needs to be able to look at liberalism in the eye and say, you know, as Jamie Gorelick did in a very small way and on a small corner of this in 1994, this is not the Bush administration. This is the executive branch, and it needs the following powers. And we can pretend that our in the abstract values and our needs are absolutely congruent, but I'm looking you in the eye and I'm telling you that they're not, and we're going to need to do some things that are pretty ugly, and I want you to take responsibility for them as well as I take responsibility for them. That's that's a sort of a pathology that's developed on the left that really needs to be unlearned, and it's going to take a very serious bit of leadership on the part of the next Democratic president to teach the left, you know, to sort of take a few steps back. The other side of it is there's this pathology on the right that if you're not as tough as we are on any given thing, the next attack is your fault. And this is incredibly destructive because it puts liberals in the position of sign on or else. And the truth is it's unanswerable because you're never going to do everything you could do. I mean, if we really wanted to, you know, sign away our values, we'd waterboard everybody. I mean, you know, people say, well, it doesn't work. Well, it might work, right? Why not try it? And the answer is that, you know, we have some pretty deep-seated moral objections to that. And we're going to live with those moral objections. So there's always going to be the point at which you won't go further. And you in a democratic rule of law society, you have to accept that there is some limitation. And the rule can't be, you know, the equivalent of, you know, George Carlin's, and anybody who's driving faster than me is a maniac, and anybody who's driving slower is an asshole. The equivalent has to be, there has to be an understanding that these are very, very hard questions, and people in good faith are going to draw those lines in different places, and you know, liberals might perfectly legitimately be a little bit more squeamish about interrogation than conservatives in some instances might be, and I think, you know, you're going to have, I actually find it encouraging that both McCain and Obama are sort of people who, you know, speak a language about, you know, sincerely or insincerely, you know, in reality or not in reality, speak a language of reaching across and, you know, understanding, you know, where people on the other side are coming from. And I think there's really something to that in this area, and that we need to get back to a little bit of that here.
I think that's a great note to end on. Let's tell the people when your book is in stores.
Book is out June 19th, and I'm very excited about it.
Well, congratulations. As always, Ben, it's a pleasure and a privilege.
And you?
Thank you.
Thank you.